From the Missouri School of Journalism, welcome to Global Journalist. I'm Jason McClure. Now, if you listen to this show regularly, chances are you're something of a news junkie. So on today's show, we'll be taking a look at how the news gets reported in some very different parts of the world. Now, in a few minutes, we'll talk to a journalist from Ghana who's been reporting on chronic malnutrition and the problems of food security in that West African nation. In addition, as tensions between India and Pakistan are again spiking, we'll meet an Indian journalist who's writing a book on how the Indian media can cover Muslims. But up first, we're going to turn our attention to China and Hong Kong. Hong Kong, of course, has been the site of large protests against Beijing this summer, and Chinese language media has been divided on how it covers these. On the one hand, mainland Chinese outlets have parroted Communist Party propaganda, calling the protesters, quote, anti-China forces. Other Hong Kong-based outlets have been resolutely critical of Chinese President Xi Jinping and Hong Kong's pro-mainland chief executive. One outlet has tried to straddle the divide. That's a Hong Kong-based digital news startup called The Initium. Launched in 2015, The Initium tries to be an inclusive news outlet for the entire Chinese-speaking world. Now, that's no easy task, given the Communist Party's control over mainland media, as well as distrust in Hong Kong society for media with links to the mainland. So here to talk more about how The Initium tries to walk this tightrope is Yan Zhang. She's a reporter for The Initium based in Beijing. She helped form the outlet's first mainland China reporting team. She's here in the U.S. on a fellowship from the Alfred Friendly Press Partners, where she spent some time working at USA Today. Yan, welcome.
Thank you for introducing me. My name is Yan. It's very nice to meet you, Jason.
Well, it's a pleasure to have you. Well, start out by telling us about the Initium. It was founded with this idea that it could report neutrally on the entire Chinese-speaking world, Hong Kong, China, Taiwan. What sorts of challenges are there?
Well, you know, we share different cultures from mainland China and Hong Kong and Taiwan, but we all Chinese speaking people. So we sort of share the whole Chinese community, but we have different opinions about social culture, about law system, and about the political issue. So our challenge is get people together to try to provide some specific topics about the environment, about education or healthcare, you know, who will have some influence in the whole Chinese community to get people to discuss it, to take a view of it, and to share some opinions with each other. That is our challenge, and that is what we are doing right now.
And that must be particularly challenging now at a time when tensions are very, very high between people in Hong Kong and the government in the mainland. How much more leeway do you think that your organization has to report on what is happening in Hong Kong than other Chinese-speaking news outlets?
Well, I wish I were covering Hong Kong on the ground at this moment, because all of my colleagues, they are on the streets, not for protest, but for recording what people are doing and what is the protest is going on in Hong Kong. And for us, it's not, you know, we don't focus on, only focus on provide those radical moments to our readers and audience, because that's too radical and that's too easy to forget. We trying to talk to local people and international passengers in Hong Kong, and also the government and different NGOs, different groups of people, trying to get the whole picture about what is going on in Hong Kong, why people are on the street, and why some of the people, they don't agree with the protest or demonstration, and what the government opinion, and what other foreign media, you know, they are covering, how, which way of foreign media is they covering Hong Kong right now.
And do you find that people in Hong Kong, do they trust your news outlet to report the news accurately? Are they concerned that it's censored? You yourself are from mainland China. Does your audience in Hong Kong, do they trust what you report?
I think people trust us because Hong Kong is a society which enjoys freedom of speech, and the Initium media in Hong Kong, which enjoys very high reputation in Hong Kong society. We have a lot of readers, and they know us. They appreciate what the articles and stories we've done. And when our colleagues, they are on the street, they try to talk to people. They don't have bias or paranoia. They just ask people why you are here. Could you please share your personal stories with me? And if you are not comfortable to tell your full name, you can give me your given name or surname or sort of things like that. Just tell us, because if you want the outside world to know why you are doing this and what is going on in your hometown, you should speak to the media.
Well, let me ask you about the response to your news organization within mainland China, because that seems like you yourself would be in a particularly difficult situation, even before the current sort of levels of tensions, given that this news site, the Initium, is one of those that's blocked by the great firewall. Mm-hmm. What challenges do you face as a reporter for a Hong Kong-based news outlet in the mainland?
Well, in mainland China, people hardly visit our website and apps in some way because of the technological reason. And for me, if I do some interviews in mainland China, first of all, I need to introduce who is Initium. I need to let them know we are not, you know, pro-Beijing or pro-Hong Kong. We're just a neutral media platform trying to let the outside world know what is China. So it's no matter you are media from Hong Kong or from US or you are local Chinese media, people just don't want to talk to media because they want to protect themselves. They don't want to cause any trouble. So it's very hard to open their mouths.
Well, it sounds like you have a very, very difficult job in many ways. Why did you want to get into journalism?
Well, I'm not going to say it's a very, very difficult job. I think it's challenging, but it's also very interesting. It's influenced me a lot because I can know different levels of the society. I talk to underground people. I talk to some high political figures and also some educated people in this society to get different opinions. It's very, very important because China is so diverse. So if the outside world, they see China, they might have some pictures about the poverty or about the rising of China, maybe a threat of the whole world, but actually China is different. I want to give the outside world more and more details about that.
Well, let me ask you if I could. So you've been in the U.S. for several months through this fellowship from the Alfred Friendly Press Partners Foundation. You've been working as a journalist at USA Today in the Washington, D.C. area. Before the Hong Kong protests, I think probably one of the biggest news stories about China is the trade war between the U.S. and China. And you, having spent both a significant amount of time both in the U.S. and in China, do you have a sense that people in China have a good understanding of what the U.S.'s complaints are? And conversely, do you have a feeling that people in the U.S. have a good understanding of what China's complaints are in this dispute?
I'm sorry to say, I don't think so.
Okay.
Yeah, because we have a very huge information gap between the two countries. And for Chinese readers, they cannot read English news very often. So they barely know about what is going on in U.S. And in the state media's propaganda, maybe U.S. could be an enemy or, you know, at the opposite side for the country. And there is a popular opinion in Chinese society that what caused the trade war is U.S. is not happy to see the rising of China. So I believe this kind of thinking, you know, dominates the Chinese society a little bit. And from the U.S. side, as I said, China is diverse and China is different, but U.S. people maybe don't know how to describe so complicated country from their point of view. And I'm lucky I am here and I can provide more details from China to let my editors in Washington, D.C. to know what is going on between the U.S.-China trade war, those individuals, those small companies, small businesses, how would they react and what's their future?
Well, Yan Zhang, thanks so much for taking the time to join us.
Thank you so much.
This is Global Journalist. On today's program, we're talking about some of the different challenges for journalists in different parts of the world as they work to build an informed public. We just spoke with Yan Zhang, a Beijing-based reporter for a Hong Kong news outlet called The Initium. Up next, we're going to turn to India, another country that has been much in the news this summer, as its Hindu nationalist government has moved to tighten control over the disputed Muslim-majority region of Kashmir on the border of Pakistan. Joining us now to talk more about India and especially the status of Muslims in the country is Dinesh Raza. He's a journalist for the Hindustan Times. That's India's second largest English language daily. And he's actually in the process of writing a handbook for reporters in India on how to cover Muslims in the country. Like Yan Zhang, he's here in the U.S. on a fellowship from the Alfred Friendly Press Partners. Dinesh, welcome.
Thank you for having me here.
Well, it's a pleasure to have you. I mean, talk to us about what issues you see with how the Indian media covers Islam and why you feel the need to write a handbook.
So what happened was that around 4 or 5 years ago, I started focusing on these multiple independent news outlets, digital, portals, which were emerging in response to what they say was lack of effective coverage by the mainstream media when it comes to Muslims and Islam. So I started speaking with the...
So we should say that India, it's about 80% Hindu, about 14% Muslim, is that right? But, and so much of the mainstream media...
But even that 14% translates into huge number. I mean, in terms of absolute numbers, India has the third largest Muslim population in the world after Pakistan and Indonesia.
Sure.
So people running these websites, they told me that we are not very happy with how the mainstream media covers the population, Muslim population. By that, they meant to say they found the coverage very generalized. They said it lacked objectivity. And they also said that, according to them, the reporters with mainstream media were not very literate about the religion and culture. And I discovered that, I mean, although I am trying to work on how to cover Muslims and Islam, but it is something which goes beyond one particular religion. So my idea is to find out how can we in our newsrooms become more inclusive. So I'm starting with knowing more about Muslims and Islam. And eventually I plan to, make journalists, my fellow reporters, more inclusive and more literate about different religions in the country. So even as a Muslim, when I want to write about Hinduism or Hindu culture or anything about the other religion, even I would want to be more inclusive in my coverage.
Sure, and I think this is interesting because that actually has some significant parallels with some of the issues in the U.S. with how racial minorities, religious minorities, women, LGBT people are portrayed in the media as well. But I want to ask you about another issue that journalists both in India and the U.S. I think face, and that's the spread of fake news online, especially via social media. And I understand that there have been many, many stories in India, particularly in advance of the most recent election, that were just false, that would get wide circulation on WhatsApp. I think there was one where there was a fake news story about the Islamic State offering to pay people to convert Hindus or other religious groups to Islam. Talk to us about that.
Well, just to give you perspective first. So India happens to be the largest market of WhatsApp in the world. All right. It is hard to find any smartphone which does not have WhatsApp on it. And one of the consequences of this is that along with a lot of positive information, India has become a huge market for fake news and misleading information. And people find it very hard to segregate, the truth from fake news. As a result of which, time and again, we see misleading information, posts,
and this has real world consequences too. I think one of the stories you've highlighted in your reporting was a fake news story about a group of men being involved in child trafficking.
Yes.
Seven of them were lynched. They were killed.
Yes. I mean, this is like unprecedented. And
it was fake. The whole story was fake.
Yeah. So that's what, I mean, what can be the consequence of this fake news depends on which region or which city, which pocket in India is it going to be spread. So this particular event, which you, the tragedy which you spoke about, happened in Northeast, where literacy rate is not very high, number one. Number two, that particular area is extremely prone to child trafficking. So people thought that, okay, these are the child traffickers, we know about them, so let's just fix the problem ourselves. So, and time and again, a lot of even the Indian government and digital rights activists have approached companies such as Facebook and Google to do something. The companies say that they are trying their best, but on the ground, it seems that there's not much of a difference even now. Yeah.
I wanted to ask you about another area where I think there are potentially some parallels between the U.S. and in India. In India now, it's ruled by this political party, the BJP. The prime minister is Narendra Modi, and they're very much a Hindu nationalist political party and supported by a number of groups that are fairly radical Hindu extremists in their ideology. I understand that you, as a Muslim reporter, have done a lot of reporting on this issue and have actually interviewed people from these groups. Talk to us about what that's like.
Well, so yeah, interestingly, in terms of the ideology, yes, you are right. They are trying to push an aggressive Hindu agenda. But in my reporting experience, I've never...
Correct me if I'm wrong here. I think your home minister, he recently called Muslim migrants termites and other sort of names like that.
I believe, I understand that in one of his political rallies, he said that. And he said that, and he was referring to a new scheme they are working on to identify who all are illegal migrants in India, and they need to move out. So they are trying to identify those huge chunk of the population. In that regard, he said that yes, if they are here, this is how I view them. And they should be identified and they should not be living here.
Well, I'm sorry, I interrupted you. You were talking about your experiences interviewing Hindu nationalists.
Yes, yeah, so I was saying that personally, it's interesting that I've met people who would tell me that overall speaking, we wouldn't want people of your religion to be in India, but we have no problem with you. So they spoke to me about why they do what they do. And I've spoken to them. I've spent a lot of time with them. And they said that what we are doing, our agenda is beyond any political party. It is for the larger goal of a Hindu nation. Yeah.
And while you're here, you've been working at the Minneapolis Star Tribune through this fellowship with the Alfred Friendly Press Partnership. You've been here for several months. Do you see any parallels between the nationalist political rhetoric in India and some of the rhetoric in the United States?
Well, frankly, I could not observe the rhetoric over here up close. But yes, it is hard to deny the parallels. Yes, there are parallels. I think minorities in both the nations would certainly want their governments to give them the assurance that they are safe. And the governments, I think, in both the nations should do a little more to make the minority population feel, at home. And there should be a trickle-down effect. It should not end with a rhetoric. People should see it on the ground, basically. So, yeah.
Well, Dinesh Raza, thank you so much for taking the time to join us.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Cheers. Yeah. A reminder that you're tuned into Global Journalist. I'm Jason McClure. On today's program, we're talking about some challenges for journalists in three quite different developing nations. Our final guest comes to us from the West African nation of Ghana. Now, Ghana has managed to build both a robust democracy and enjoy strong economic growth over the past two decades. But parts of the country are still quite poor. And in the northern part of the country, nearly one in three children have their growth stunted due to malnutrition. So joining us now to talk about some of the challenges Ghana faces, both in feeding its population and in its media environment, is Justice Baidu. He's a journalist for Ghana's Joy News. He's reported on issues about farming, agriculture, and hunger extensively. And he's been in the U.S. studying food security issues at the University of Missouri, as well as at the Danforth Plant Science Center on a fellowship from the Alfred Friendly Press Partners Program. Justice, pleasure to have you.
Pleasure to be here. Thank you very much for having me.
Well, talk to us first. I wanted to ask you about an article that you wrote in 2017 that won a big award on food sustainability in Ghana, and it highlighted how much agricultural production goes to waste there. To tell us about that story.
So again, thank you for having me, and it's a pleasure to be here and speaking specifically about that story. It was one of those stories where you travel on an assignment and you really don't have that in mind as that story that you're going to do. So we had gone to this community to do a story about how smoke from the firewood that women use in preparing gari, which is a local staple, affect the health of the women in the long term. And so we had gone into this community, which is huge producer.
So you wanted to do a health story people inhaling smoke and the health problems as a result, but instead you found something else.
Yes, we had gone there too. And it happens a lot that you find some of these things. And we went to this place where more than 200 women would usually come on any day to process the cassava into the gari, and it's a big source of livelihood for women and even men in this community. But in this week, we found that there was no activity, and it was mainly because the cassava production, even though it was at its peak, the supply to places like this community was not coming, and it was because the roads that are connecting this community to some of the other communities in the hinterland where the cassava is mainly grown had been blocked by the rains, because this was in August. It was at the peak of the rainy season in Ghana. I found this interesting, and so I just said to one of these women, can we just have a trip to one of these communities and see what we can find? And we just documented the story. I mean, for me, working as a journalist that had traveled all through Ghana doing some of these stories, it wasn't particularly new because I also grew up in a family where farming was something that we used as a means of a livelihood. And so we knew about how many farmers would farm all through the year and would end up having to look at their produce getting rotten on the farm only because there are no roads.
They couldn't transport it to market, to a processing
them to
center.
Market, because at the peak of the rainy season, a lot of these feeder roads are blocked, and they are basically on more trouble. And that, for me, was, I found a way of telling the story from the perspective of these farmers and hearing them talk about how they are not sure how they are going to survive for the coming season because they are unable to sell their produce. And this is a country where we have more than half of the people in this industry, which is agriculture and farming related activities. And so some of these things have far-reaching impact. It has impact for women who are processing gari in that village who will not have it because they are not getting the cassava. The women who are in these farming communities who will not be able to sell because the roads are bad, they then wouldn't be able to see their children through school because, I mean, when they don't sell, they don't have money to
much
put their
less the people would be
school.
The consumers of this then, and
exactly, and then
families.
Consumers in the cities like Accra also have if they have the produce at all, it comes at sometimes twice or thrice the price should ordinarily be, and so it has far-reaching impact. And
well,
that was the story.
Let me ask you, and that sounds like an interesting story, but you mentioned something before the taping to me as well that was quite interesting. You were talking about the state of Ghanaian media, and Ghana is known as a country that's sort of a haven for the media, especially in West Africa, where there are a number of authoritarian regimes, where dissent isn't tolerated, where criticism of the government isn't tolerated. Ghana is very, very different in that respect. And yet, it sounds like you also have some concerns about how the media environment is functioning in Ghana right now. Tell us about that.
Yeah, I mean, Ghana is definitely a haven. And if you relatively to other African countries when it comes to freedom of speech, democracy, and our democratic history, I feel proud when I travel around the world and have people who have read about us, have been to Ghana, come up to me and say, oh, I like Ghana. You've changed from one party to another through a clean election, even though sometimes disputed, but we've never had instances like we've had in other African countries where there's bloodshed, where people have had to flee and all of that. And so generally, yes, we are a relatively good place to work, more so as a journalist. But it hasn't quite been a smooth journey for many journalists, especially people who work in what is seen as critical media.
And we should point out as well that there was an investigative journalist who was killed relatively recently working for a very well-known undercover investigative journalist named Anas there. But I'm sorry, I interrupted you.
Yes, and that is just one of recent happenings that has given cause for many of us to speak up and have a concern about where our industry is going in Ghana.
But this point aside, though, one of the things that is interesting about Ghana is that it's a two-party system, just like the United States is, where two parties essentially change who is in power, rotate who is in power. And it sounds like, similar to the U.S., the media in Ghana is becoming polarized around these two parties.
Exactly. And I think I get a sense that the polarization that is happening in our media now is in many ways a reflection of how polarized our society itself is. And a lot of people, especially people in political office and politically exposed people, their business friends, I get a sense, are taking advantage of this polarization to sort of pitch the people against the media. Yes, there are many challenges in our media setup, which means that not all of us get it correct in terms of our reporting. But what I get the sense is happening now is a deliberate agenda to sort of run down the credibility of the media in a way that would reduce the level of trust that the people would have in especially critical media. When that happens, then what happens is that they are able to get away with some of the wrongs that go on. So, for example, in the instance of Anas's journalist that was killed, huge investigation about corruption in our football. What happens if they are able to run down the credibility of the journalists involved? Then what it means that people would place less trust in some of these stories, and then they are able to get away with some of the rot.
Well, that sounds sounds like there's some parallels to that in the United States as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And I've been speaking to people, and when Donald Trump calls media in the U.S. as fake news, and people who are working all around the country producing quality journalism and refers to them as fake news, I get a sense the whole idea is to make them look less credible in a way that you are then able to get people to rubbish any journalism that comes out of some of these places.
Well, Justice Baidoo, thank you so much for taking the time to join us.
Thank you very much. I'm grateful.
We're out of time for this edition of Global Journalist, a production of the Reynolds Journalism Institute at the Missouri School of Journalism and KBIA, Mid-Missouri Public Radio. Many thanks again to Justice Baidoo, Yan Zhang, Dennis Raza, and the Alfred Friendly Press Partners Program. Takiya Thomas is audio engineer and Travis McMillan is director. Our executive editor is Kathy Keeley. For all of us at Global Journalist, I'm Jason McClure. Thanks for tuning in.